It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this morning, Hurricane Idalia made landfall near Keaton Beach, Florida, as a Category 3 hurricane with 125-mile-an-hour winds. A couple hours after landfall, the storm remained as a Category 1 hurricane and started heading toward Georgia and South Carolina. Hundreds of thousands of homes in Florida and Georgia are without power at this point, according to AP News. Idalia is the biggest storm we've seen this year in what's already predicted to be an especially busy Atlantic hurricane season, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Our next guest is a hurricane expert here in Wisconsin who's been watching this storm closely. Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's great to talk to you.
We've heard this called an unprecedented event, the way this hurricane has hit, where it's hit. What stands out to you, John, about this hurricane?
Yeah, so first, if you can picture a map of Florida in your head, there's a transition area between the Florida Peninsula, which is, you know, sticks southward, Tampa, Orlando, Miami, and the Panhandle, which is kind of that northwestern kind of panhandle. And it's an area that the coast, the Gulf Coast, called the Big Bend. And generally, we can get a lot of strong hurricanes, say, in parts of southwest Florida and eastern Florida and into the Panhandle of Florida. But we haven't had many at all go into this Big Bend region. That's this area well north of Tampa and well east of, say, Destin and Panama City. And so this particular hurricane, being a Category 3 at landfall, was the Big Bend's. It actually tied for the strongest hurricane on record by wind speed, and that tie was from 1896. So, this is a pretty unusually strong hurricane for that Big Bend region.
Remind us what makes something a Category 3 storm and what other factors go into determining how destructive a hurricane can be.
Sure. So hurricanes are categorized based on their winds. 1, 2, and 3, that's based on the maximum sustained winds that a hurricane has. And in this particular case, it actually reached Category 4 intensity just before landfall, and then it weakened a little bit, broadened its wind field a little bit, and it was a Cat 3 at landfall. So that's all based on wind speed. But a hurricane is much more than winds. And frankly, some of its more deadly aspects are from water, not wind. So storm surge, this is the push of water from the ocean to the coast. And we saw a storm surge inundation of up to 8 feet along parts of the Big Bend coast this morning, say around the town of Steinhatchee, Florida. So that's a storm surge. And then you have the danger from rainfall flooding. We've already had some reports of up to 6 inches of rain in parts of Georgia. And now, as I'm looking at radar now, we're having heavy rain in eastern Georgia and parts of the Carolinas. So hurricanes are categorized by wind, but they're also dangerous because of the water, both from the ocean and also falling out of the sky.
The storm Idalia is moving over, as you said, Georgia, then the Carolinas, then out into the Atlantic. There were some points where there was a concern, I think, that Idalia could potentially curve back and hit the southeast U.S. again. What are the projections at this point?
Yeah, that was some interesting forecast model solutions we had yesterday, showing this clockwise loop back toward Florida. Well, the latest forecast models aren't showing that much at all now. We're expecting Idalia to be downgraded to a tropical storm at some point later today. It'll scrape the Carolinas through, say, Thursday afternoon, and then eventually it'll just kind of move slowly out toward Bermuda this weekend, and it'll just kind of sit out there for a while and eventually start to drift back toward the northeast. So we don't think there's much of a concern. We can't completely rule it out just yet, but we think the chances of it looping back toward the U.S. at this point are very low.
Talking to Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com, looking at Hurricane Idalia going through the southeastern United States right now and hurricane season in general. John, this idea of rapid intensification, it seems like with a lot of our big hurricanes over the last few years now, that phrase has come up. What are we talking about when we talk about rapid intensification?
Yeah, it pretty much is as it sounds. It's a tropical storm or a tropical depression that just undergoes really fast intensification. Meteorologists say if it increases its winds by 35 miles per hour in 24 hours or less, it's considered a rapidly intensifying storm. And, you know, when I first started getting into this about 25 years ago, rapid intensifiers were pretty infrequent in any year. They were really notable when we got one. And now it seems like I can't see a hurricane that doesn't rapidly intensify. So we had Idalia. We had another hurricane, by the way, out there between Bermuda and the East Coast, Hurricane Franklin. That also rapidly intensified. And we see a lot of rapid intensifiers out in the Western Pacific. They're called typhoons out there. And that's basically because there's a lot of moisture in the atmosphere and there's very warm water and there's very low wind shear. So when that happens, these tropical storms and hurricanes can intensify quickly. And that's always a bit unnerving, especially when they're near landfall.
I've actually wanted to give you a call for weeks now, John. I keep reading about a heat wave, a marine heat wave in the waters, especially around Florida, not just there, though. And I've been wanting to ask you, how much could that affect hurricanes? How much does that raise the risk of things like rapid intensification?
Well, it certainly raises the risk. I mean, that's the main fuel source for tropical storms and hurricanes is deep, warm ocean water, which then transfers to the air and makes the air warm, sticky, and humid. And that's what you need to generate thunderstorms, which are the building blocks of hurricanes. So that is our big concern for the rest of hurricane season, is that it's not just the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, the Gulf of Mexico is record warm in July, basically still near record warmth, if not record warm for this time of year now. You have all this reservoir of warm water, and all it takes is a storm to sit over that warm water. As long as it doesn't have shearing winds over the top of it or dry air, that storm could go pretty quickly. So that's a continued concern all the way through the end of hurricane season, despite the fact that we have an El Nino in play, which usually puts the brakes on our hurricane season.
I also wanted to ask you about this Hilary storm. Usually we're talking about the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico when we talk hurricanes. Well, this is the southwestern United States and Baja California in Mexico. How unusual was that?
Well, it's not unusual to have remnants of tropical storms and hurricanes come out of the eastern Pacific. So that area, say, west of the west coast of Mexico, and then eventually get pulled up towards, say, the desert southwest, parts of Arizona and the deserts of California and Nevada and so on and so forth. That usually happens at least one or two times a year. Mm-hmm. But what's unusual about Hilary is that it was pulled up unusually far to the west, such that it was still a tropical storm when it was over Southern California. In fact, one of the more surreal things I saw out of Hilary is when the tropical storm was actually centered right over L.A. And, that is exceedingly rare. And it pulled all that rain right over the L.A. Basin and then into the deserts of Southern California. So that is extremely rare to have a tropical storm still classified as a tropical storm over Southern California and the L.A. Basin.
Bringing things back to today's news, John, a hurricane, Idalia. Now, it went from a Category 3 at landfall down to a Category 1 hurricane. It seems, from my hurricane memory, and you'll know better than I do, it seems like it maintained hurricane status further inland than this usually happens. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Rob, that's a great point to make. So sometimes what will happen is a hurricane is moving so fast. I mean, it's now currently moving at 20 miles per hour, which is pretty fast for a hurricane. That when it makes landfall, it just doesn't, if it's moving faster, it doesn't have as much time to slow down, you know, wind down and weaken. So you get these hurricane force winds pushing farther inland for a faster moving hurricane than a slower moving hurricane. So that's what we saw with Idalia. We had some, you know, gusts over 80 miles per hour in parts of North Florida and, you know, some stronger wind gusts also in South Georgia. So occasionally when that happens, we can have a hurricane hold on to its status a bit longer than it normally would once it's away from the ocean water.
And briefly, John, a bit of good news maybe. Slower moving hurricanes may dump more water on one particular spot.
That can be good and bad news. You know, if you're in a drought, you like the good soaking, but it can be a bad news case if it's a slower moving hurricane. Mm-hmm. It can produce flooding rain pretty quickly.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Wisconsin's own Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. We've been looking at this year's hurricane season and the latest updates from Florida and now Georgia and the Carolinas, where Hurricane Idalia made landfall, earlier today. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Recent polls show more and more people question the trustworthiness of their media sources. Journalists are trying to rebuild that trust, especially at the local level. But a lot of smaller media outlets are struggling to stay afloat and produce quality reporting with declining revenues. Our next guest researched new ideas to help reporters and editors engage with their communities and strengthen their relationship with their audiences. Susan Robinson is a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. I recently talked to her about her new book. It's called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. Here's a listen. There have been a lot of conversations about declining trust in the media. That's a part of the focus of your book. And can you start us off by defining what you're talking about when you say trust in the context of journalists trying to rebuild it?
I'm so glad that you're asking me to nuance that, because so often when we ask people, hey, do you trust news media? People think about cable pundits, right? Mm-hmm. And they think about national news, and they think about all of the misinformation that's swirling out there in lots of different circles. But what I'm talking about here really is more about local news. I'm talking about trust in your local reporters, trust in the news as an institution. But I'm also now talking about trust as a relationship that you may have both with the content that's happening about your news and the things that matter to you, but also the individual reporters who are out there producing it every day.
And a lot of your message is for somebody who's operating, publishing, editing, or reporting for some kind of local news outlet. What are some first steps that they can take to, I guess, do a trust inventory to see how much collateral they have with the communities they're out there covering?
Well, one of the things that I do is called applied research. So I work with organizations that work with newsrooms. So Trusting News, Harkin, Solutions Journalism Network, these nonprofit agencies that go in and help newsrooms think about engagement with audiences in much different ways than we used to think about it. And so what this book does is it documents this giant, massive retraining that's been happening over the last 10 years around engagement journalism, moving away from sort of this source-driven content and more towards developing relationships in different ways with all kinds of communities and all kinds of people. And so one of the things that this book has in the conclusion, of course, we have to have recommendations in every conclusion, is for journalists to think about how they're trying to reconfigure those relationships and their very specific suggestions.
Yeah. Can you give us a couple of those? What could they in local media coverage be doing?
Sure. So one of the things we've been doing a lot of over the last 2 years is asking journalists to conduct listening sessions with people who are not engaged with their brand. And so with the journalists that we've been trying to do this, we did 87 conversations. About half of those conversations were with people who identified as right-leaning and were completely distrustful of the local news brand. And the other half were with BIPOC groups, Native Americans or immigrants or African-Americans. And what we found was that even after 30 minutes of being listened to, and often these transcripts, by the way, were full of sort of anger and vitriol and just a lot of fear about journalism. Even after that 30 minutes, we asked these community members, hey, like, what did that conversation do for you in terms of trust building? And 87% of those community members after this interview said, yes, actually, this little 30 to 40 minute session where I didn't allow the journalist to get a word in edgewise really built trust, not only in the journalist, but also in the brand. And more startlingly, more than a third of them said they would consider subscribing, which is huge, right? And so what we're trying to do is, how do we scale that, right? Because it's really hard to have those kinds of sessions with local and mid-sized newsrooms that are just already so constrained.
Now, let's talk about those constraints. I imagine a response you'll get from somebody at a local paper, and I feel this here in broadcast too, is, this all sounds great. I've got a deadline. I've got a show to do today. I've got three articles and then the web treatment and so to do. When do we find time to do that kind of outreach that doesn't help me meet that deadline?
Yeah. And I should say that I was a journalist for a long time before I became a journalism professor. And I so feel that. And journalists today, they have so many financial pressures, but also more and more physical pressures, right? There's more and more violence against journalists, even in the US these days. They're doing really heroic work, I think, out on the front lines in all kinds of different situations. So we try to break everything down into little nuggets, little snacks of change, so to speak, because nobody can change everything that they do in the next couple of days, right? So for example, we look a lot at word choice and the kinds of terms that you use in headlines or you use in leads, which is the first sentence of any news article if you're in print. Checking in with people in the newsroom and trying to figure out like what kind of individuals do we have that are represented right here, not just racially or politically, but do we have any veterans? Do we have religious people? Do we have people who own guns? In order to understand all of the dimensions of difference, not only of how we're covering something, but also that are represented in all of our communities.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Sue Robinson. Her new book is called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, for the most part, I just don't trust the media, local media as well. I've been involved in open records requests with our school district. I've had conversations with reporters. I've seen them distort story after story or not report stories that were of interest to the community. The only thing I would say to everyone is be your own fact checker. Do not trust any individual source. Always ask the question, how are they trying to dupe me into believing their side of a story?
And Steve, before I let you go, I don't want to put a label on you. What would you consider your political perspective if somebody made you put a label on yourself?
I am a libertarian.
All right. Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. Sue, do you have thoughts for Steve and maybe for a media outlet, whether it's, you know, they've got the 2 days a week paper or the Sun Prairie Star and Sun Prairie or a Madison-based outlet to reach out to someone with Steve's perspective?
Yeah. And I think we hear that perspective more and more, especially as we have all of these misinformation bots and we have all of these players in the game who are intentionally trying to throw information chaos into our public deliberation and our discourse. And so that's a tall order. And one of the things that we suggest is massive radical transparency so that every single story, particularly, for example, the K-12 school, anything about the school districts that you have next to your story or embedded within the story, all of links to information, links to the evidence, you know, all of that together. And so that's just one of the things that we need to be doing these days, just because of the state of the institution. I will say that I think journalists, local journalists, particularly those who are writing for the papers that you mentioned, are very, very trustworthy. It's just that there's a grand narrative that's out there right now telling a story that, you know, these reporters are out to dupe them. I have not seen that. And I've been doing research for about 19 years now, where I'm actually asking journalists, talking to journalists, surveying journalists, focus groups with journalists. I just have not seen that local or mid journalists or even national journalists are out to dupe anybody. I think that what's happening is there's a massive restructuring that's happened in the industry, and journalists are being asked to take on 4 or 5 jobs. And so they're not able to be at every single school board member meeting like they used to be able to. And so what we're just suggesting in this retraining that I document in the book is that they sort of shift their priorities and stop doing stuff like the meeting stories and doing more different kinds of engaged work that is operating from within community rather than without.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Sue, can you point us toward somebody you think is getting it right? Whether it's a project that's working across multiple newsrooms or a particular media outlet where you're seeing them do stuff, they're building that trust with their community, and you think they're getting it right.
I mean, honestly, public radio across the nation and even Wisconsin, they've been doing it right for a long time. A lot of our nonprofit agencies have been doing right. And Madison's lucky enough to have a saturated media city. And I know personally a lot of the journalists who work at the Isthmus or the Wisconsin State Journal or the Milwaukee Journalist Sentinel or, you know, Channel 3000, Madison Magazine, all of these organizations are doing it right. It's just that circumstances right now are really difficult. They've lost out on their three major tiers of revenue streams. So they're trying to figure out a new business model, even as the information needs of audiences have changed. And so one of the things I'd like to ask is for people to be patient. And to also to follow the models of, for example, public radio, where they're reaching out to different communities, building trust in different ways, trying new things, experimenting. And some of those things are going to fail. But, you know, it's the only way that we're going to continue to have local journalism survive.
And just our last minute, thoughts for when the newsroom in some significant way is different than the people they cover. That could mean a mostly white newsroom covering a community of color. It could mean, you know, news industry concentrated in the city and they want to do a good job covering small towns and rural areas. Can you leave us with some thoughts on how to bridge that gap?
Right. We work a lot with Trusting News, and they have a project called Dimensions of Difference that you can just Google and look at all of the different kits and the guides that we've helped them come up with. And then we evaluate them and then we tweak the guides. And those help journalists understand what their differences are. They help them figure out like what questions that they can ask. They help them learn how to identify and then create relationships with different influencers on different kinds of platforms that represent the differences, the perspectives that they're missing maybe. And so I would point people to that.
So we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Susan Robinson is a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. Her latest book is called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, India's Chandrayaan-3 mission landed a spacecraft on the southern pole of the moon. Here's the reaction in their control room the moment the lander touched down.
Ji ha, aap apne screen pe dekh sakte hain ki hum lander module.
It's the newest major development in modern space exploration at a time when a mix of government-run and private space programs are aiming for the moon and beyond. The successful landing came just days after a Russian lander crashed in an attempt to do the same thing. Our next guest has been following the latest developments in the international space race, the significance of India's success, and what it all means for the future of space exploration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you excited about space exploration? Do you want to see more American space missions? How about bringing people back to the moon? Now, what questions do you have for our expert on the space industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks very much. Good to talk to you again.
Let's start with this new successful landing from India. How big a deal was this for, I guess, another more recent entry into the quest to land things on places that aren't Earth?
For India, it was a huge deal. You know, they had tried to do this 3 years earlier with a Chandrayaan-2 mission, and they failed because they had some computer issues and that spacecraft crashed into the lunar surface. And so this was their second attempt, and country had put a lot on this. The leader of the nation, Narendra Modi, has really played up sort of the space ambitions of India and as a point of national pride. And so there was a lot riding on the landing attempt this week. And the other matter is, you know, in Asia, India really sees itself as a competitor with China, and China's spacecraft program is pretty far ahead. They've had several successful lunar landings and actually returned some rocks from the moon a couple of years ago robotically. And so it was really important for India's national pride, I think, for this mission to be a success.
Yeah, I use the phrase space race, and I try to throw a little air quotes around it. I mean, are we in a competitive environment where countries and or private industry are trying to hit that next milestone before whoever they perceive their competitors to be?
You know, it's really complicated, but it is accurate, I think, to say we're in a sort of a second generation space race. It's very different from the 1960s when it was just the United States and Soviet Union sort of, you know, marching out into the heavens. Now there are a mix of national players, and it's not just the U.S. and Russia. It's China, India, Europe, Japan, lots of different players. And then you've got commercial companies, you know, like SpaceX and Blue Origin and places like that that are all really playing in this area and doing interesting things as well. And so there's lots of activity out there.
Now, this is the South Pole of the Moon. I want to talk about why this seems to be so interesting scientifically, technologically. Why is this part of the moon getting so much attention these days?
Well, it really goes back about 10 or 15 years ago when NASA crashed a probe into the South Pole of the Moon to basically see if in these permanently shadowed craters there was water ice. And they produced some not definitive, but pretty convincing evidence that yes, there is. So these areas of the moon that never see the sun, and so over, you know, billions of years, ice has accumulated there. So there's believed to be legitimately water on the moon. And if you could get water on the moon, that's a pretty handy resource to have. And so you've got all of this activity, particularly from the United States and China, of over the next 5 to 10 years of sending probes to the South Pole of the moon, investigating these permanently shadowed regions and seeing if there is really ice there to mine and to be had. And once you have ice, of course, you've got hydrogen fuel, you've got oxygen oxidizer, you can also breathe it, you can also drink the water, make it potable. So it's a pretty handy resource to have in place there. And so, you know, the Indian probe didn't quite make it to the South Pole. It was about 70 degrees south, so about kind of the northern edge of Sweden, in reference to the North Pole here on Earth. But it is certainly the closest that any probe has gotten so far to the South Pole.
And I read somewhere, I think, that Eric, the South Pole itself is a tough place to land a probe. It's rough ground. It is a challenge to get something much closer to the pole. Is that right?
Yeah, both from an energy standpoint, in terms of trying to get a spacecraft there, it is easier to go to these equatorial regions that we saw the Apollo missions go to and some of these other spacecraft. And the South Pole and the North Pole, for that matter, are a little bit more difficult, as you say, because the lighting conditions are difficult, a little more challenging to work with, and the terrain appears to be a little bit more uneven, and especially, you know, you don't really want to land on the edge of a crater, right? You'd mm-hmm. much rather have these smoother, flatter areas.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news from space, efforts to land probes on the moon, one from India successful, one from Russia not. And we'll look at what's going on in the United States as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest. Do you have a goal in mind that you'd like to see? Private companies, governments, whatever aiming for, join in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you wrote a piece about the Russian space program, the crash of their latest probe and a decline. You know, they inherited the Soviet era space program, one of the only two games in town for a long time. What has gone wrong there as you see it?
Well, you know, the Soviets had a very inventive and extraordinary space program in the 1960s and 70s. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, they really stopped innovating and putting substantial funding in. So they're basically flying the same vehicles that were developed in the 1960s and 70s. They're very good, right, at what they do for human spaceflight, but they're not modern in any sense of the word. And the fact of the matter is, you know, since the 1970s, the Russians have not sent any probe into deep space successfully. They've had some failed Mars missions, and then just earlier this summer, they attempted to land on the moon with the Luna 25 probe, and they weren't successful at crashing into the moon, which really provided, I think, a striking contrast. India comes along a couple of weeks later and successfully lands on the moon, kind of saying that, you know, India can now do something in space pretty significant that Russia has lost the capability to do.
Let's talk about international cooperation. I mean, Russia had up till, I think, fairly recently been able to cooperate with Western Europe and with the United States. That seems to have run into trouble, especially with the invasion of Ukraine. Who is and who isn't going in alone? Who's playing well with others to try to combine efforts?
Yeah, so the Russian space program had pretty deep ties, not just with NASA and the International Space Station, but certainly with the European space industry. Europe launched a lot of their Soyuz rockets from Europe's own spaceport, and then they also had this joint mission to go to Mars, where Russia was basically building a lander on a spacecraft that was built by Europe that was going to go to Mars, and so they were going to have an opportunity to have a successful mission to Mars. A lot of that cooperation broke down, and so now it's just basically a bare bones cooperation between NASA and Russia and Europe on the International Space Station and nothing else. And all of that is due to the war in Ukraine. It was really the European Space Agency backed away very quickly. And so now, you know, if we step back and look at the moon, you have two kind of competing efforts to send humans to the moon. You've got NASA with its Artemis program, and the Europeans, many of the European countries are going along with that, and other countries around the world. And then you have China and its effort to go to the moon by 2030 or the mid-2030s. And actually Russia has signed on to the Chinese effort. And so that cooperation has kind of shifted, especially in light of the Ukraine war.
Now, there's been arguments about, you know, should putting people back on the moon be a goal? How much of this, whether it's China or the U.S. and allies, is it, yeah, there's going to be genuine scientific value to putting people on the moon versus the symbolic milestone of it?
So, you know, it was all about geopolitics back in the 1960s. It was basically, is capitalism supreme or is communism supreme? And there's definitely a major geopolitical element of this current race between the United States and China. I think both nations see, you know, leading these international coalitions is very important. But the things have changed, right? And probably the biggest change, certainly for the United States, has been the rise of the commercial space industry. So it's not just about, you know, putting flags and footprints on the moon. It's really trying to lay down the ground for a sustainable operation, so long-term operation. So not just going there a few times and stopping, but actually going there and staying there and ultimately harvesting resources on the moon and potentially asteroids as well. And so there are private companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and other companies that are playing an important role as part of NASA's program. And the thought is that if NASA goes first, then it will sort of pave the way for commercial activity to follow, much like the Transcontinental Railroad sort of did in the United States, you know, 150 or 200 years ago, to kind of open up the West to settlers and commercial activity. That's a very broad metaphor. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but that's kind of big picture the goal.
We're talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at recent developments in space exploration, including the latest efforts to land probes on the south pole of the moon. Coming up, we'll look more at the private companies here in the U.S. getting in the game, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you lived through the Cold War era space race, what do you remember about that time? Did you watch the moon landing back in 1969? What are you thinking now as you watch the newest kind of space race? What should the priorities be, if any? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, or you can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. We're talking to him about the latest from space, including India's successful Chandrayaan 3 mission to the South Pole or near the South Pole of the moon and the state of the broader space industry. We're going to check out the latest from private companies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Do you want the United States to prioritize getting into space, maybe getting people on the moon, more probes to Mars? What, if anything, do you want to see as priority number one? If commercial space flight, orbital flight, whatever, got inexpensive enough, would you go? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric, I want to talk about the newest rounds of private companies getting into the space industry. Now, there's always been some level of public-private partnership going on here. Companies like Northrop, I think, and Boeing and whatever designing our older spacecraft. What companies are at the top of your list right now with the most promising developments?
Well, I think you would have to put SpaceX at the top of the list in terms of accomplishments. You know, they're the ones that they're up and launch as many as 100 rockets this year. They're going to send 3/4 of all mass sent to space this year will be launched by a single company. That's not like the United States, that's just SpaceX. And that you add up all the rest of the countries in the US and Europe and China and India. And so they're the ones doing the most interesting things. But there's a lot of other commercial activity behind SpaceX coming along as well. And so it's you know, what NASA has really done over the last 15 or 20 years is stimulate this vibrant commercial space industry, which is really kind of giving this country its edge as it looks out in the 2020s and 2030s and wants to compete with China in space.
What are some of the companies on the list, maybe far behind SpaceX, but trying to emerge?
And you've got companies doing all sorts of different things. Like there's a company called Astroscale, which is trying to build satellites and spacecraft that can go out and take care of space junk in low Earth orbit. Because there's a lot of old derelict satellites and pieces of rockets and debris up there that we could try to clean up that orbit. You've got a company like OrbitFab, which wants to build refineries in space. And so they could take water launched from Earth or collect it on the moon and produce hydrogen peroxide or other things that other companies and customers might want. Blue Origin, the company owned by Jeff Bezos, is trying to build a completely reusable transportation system between the Earth and the moon that would refuel with liquid hydrogen. And so there's just lots of innovative ideas happening. It's kind of a wild, wild west in terms of financing. You know, a lot of these space companies went public over the last couple of years with this special purpose acquisition company or SPACs, and they've not performed financially very well. So the stocks have taken a beating. And so, you know, we're sort of at a tipping point moment where we may see this industry really explode or it may take a step back.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rod is with us in La Crosse. Rod, hi.
Yes, hello. I just wondered, once they sit there and get up there and they get on the moon, and do they all start grabbing land like they did in America from the Native Americans? That, I mean, they say, well, this is my part. And then they said, go to Mars and sit there and start grabbing land there too. This country has been so greedy anyhow, the way it's been, no matter who you are. You know, humans are the worst people on the planet. I mean, animals sit there and they're far better than humans.
Rod, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, as I understand it, Eric, there is a treaty, an agreement that no one country will start marking off territory claimed to parts of the moon's surface. Is there a thought that once we actually start going there, we'll observe that?
So that's a great question. You know, I think it probably is going to work somewhat like it does in Antarctica, where countries can have outposts and bases, but no one owns any of the land in Antarctica. But that is certainly going to be a territorial dispute or potentially an issue at the South Pole, which is, you know, we're talking about tens to maybe hundreds of miles of sort of land, not a huge area, sort of at the South Pole that's really of interest, where these permanently shadowed regions are in the craters. So that is potentially something that could be disputed. And then also the commercial companies, you know, we're trying to get some assurances from the United States that, hey, you know, if I went to the moon and spent all of this money harvesting these resources, can I really resell those resources? Because, you know, they're not going to own the territory that they're on either. So the Outer Space Treaty is now 50 years old. It nominally sets up the rules of the law, which says no one can own this land, but it kind of may be the sort of thing where, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law once people get there. It's something really to watch over the next 5 to 10 years. The caller raises a great point.
Rod, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you mentioned earlier the Artemis mission, the goal over the next few years to work back to landing people on the moon, led by the U.S. with a bunch of partners. Along with that is this diplomatic effort called the Artemis Accords. As you mentioned, European countries, I think I saw Saudi Arabia, Rwanda, South Korea, Japan, others, India signed onto it, not Russia and China, but it sets out all these pretty ambitious goals on cooperation and sharing all the science and not claiming land. Is this just, you know, diplomatic paperwork, or is there something really there to these Artemis Accords?
I think there's something really there. You know, about 30 countries have signed on, and these basically set the rules of the road by which NASA and its partners are going to explore the moon. And so that means like the sharing of scientific data, you know, just kind of transparency, you know, operating out in the open, that kind of thing. It just, it's a pretty benevolent way of exploration. It says, hey, we're going to do this, and we think these are the best practices, you know, for exploring the moon in the 21st century, and we'd like you to come along. And so you've got, like you said, you've got the Artemis Accords and the nations that are sort of signed up for that. And the incentive there, of course, is if you give some money, then potentially you could have an astronaut on the surface of the moon in 10 or 15 years. And so we're likely to see that. We've already seen that with China, you know, with Canada, there will be an astronaut flying around the moon on the Artemis II mission in just a couple of years. And in the future, we're going to see European and Japanese astronauts on the surface of the moon. And then, as you said, China and Russia are, and some other countries that have signed up with them, like Venezuela, are going to go their own way.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news in space exploration. Eric, you mentioned, you know, we've got these private companies in the U.S., but a lot of them driven by NASA and federal government funding incentives. I know over the years there have been arguments, you know, where do we direct our money? Moon, Mars, people, unmanned probes, telescopes, satellites, whatever. What do you see as the latest priorities coming out of NASA that are driving some of this?
So it's really interesting. If you look at public survey after public survey, the top two priorities you get from the public are protecting the Earth from asteroids. So like, you know, being able to deflect a killer asteroid and finding them before they can hit Earth. And the other one is Earth science, understanding and studying our planet. And actually, if you look down the list, you have to go pretty far down before you find human exploration of the moon and Mars. But, you know, NASA is doing some things, a lot of things for Earth science, and is doing some things for planetary science, but the majority of its budget is spent on human exploration. And there, for a long time, there was a debate about, well, should we go back to the moon or should we go straight to Mars? And I think what we've really seen with this Artemis program, and what I like as someone who's followed the space industry for a long time, is that it does have a pretty coherent plan. It says, look, we're going to go back to the moon. It's something we can achieve within the next 5 to 10 years. And we're going to learn how to live there and work there and get the tools and strategies we need eventually to have a program to go on to Mars. And so I think the Artemis program is pretty good in concept. But we're certainly spending a lot of money on it, and as opposed to Earth science and asteroid defense.
I want to visit Mars for a moment. We've got rovers, Eric, that seem to keep outlasting their expected lifespan. I think I read a piece you wrote about the helicopter on Mars that was supposed to do 5 missions. It's done dozens, and it recovered from an unplanned landing. What do we have on the surface of Mars that you're watching right now?
Well, we've got 2 rovers, Perseverance and Curiosity. Curiosity has been there about a decade, and Perseverance for several years less. And then the helicopter has been flying along with Perseverance. Got a couple orbiters flying around the planet. And then, you know, there's China has a rover on Mars. It's active as well. And, you know, NASA's working on a mission to go to Mars and return some samples from there to study in Earth laboratories. So there's a lot going on Mars scientifically, but there is the stated goal by NASA and private companies like Elon Musk and SpaceX to send humans to Mars, you know, within the next 15 to 20 years. I'm not convinced that's feasible, but that's certainly something they're working toward.
And do you have your eyes elsewhere in the solar system? I think we mostly talk about, well, the Earth, of course, the moon and Mars. What else is going on in our neighborhood?
So there's some really exciting missions that are coming up. Next year, NASA is going to launch a probe to the Jupiter's moon Europa, which is entirely covered in ice. But it's believed to be, there's believed to be a huge ocean underneath the ice on Europa. There's more water on Europa than it exists on all the oceans here on Earth. And so that probe is going to go and fly by Europa more than 2 dozen times later this decade and return some fantastic data. And then there's another mission. It's going to Titan, which is a moon around Saturn, which has on its surface seas of liquid methane. Fascinating place. And we're going to go there and actually fly a helicopter-like object called Dragonfly around and get all kinds of information about the moons. And so the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are quite fascinating. We're finally starting to send dedicated probes there, and that's something I'm very excited about.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. He was with us to talk about recent developments in space exploration, including India's recent successful landing near the South Pole of the Moon. You can follow Eric's reporting, a lot of great information, up-to-date information on the latest rocket technology as well, at arstechnica.com. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get a preview of the Wisconsin Badger football season just in time for the opening game coming up this weekend. If you have questions, things you're going to be watching for or wondering about in this new season, get the conversation started now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the show tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Net. If you're like me, you'll probably never walk on the moon. But good news, tonight you can get a closer than usual look at it. It's the second supermoon of the month tonight, and it's a good one. NASA says a supermoon happens when a full moon corresponds to the moon's orbit being at its closest point to Earth. It's supposed to look big, bright, and cool, and we should get a great view in Wisconsin. Took a quick look at the weather, clear to mostly clear skies all over the state tonight. Start watching for moonrise after 7:30 tonight. The full moon technically is, I guess, at 8:36 p.m. As NPR reports, the moon's going to look around 8% larger and 50% brighter than a normal full moon. If you miss it tonight, it'll still be big and full for a couple more nights. By the way, you might be able to see Saturn up near the moon tonight. Lunar exploration from the comforts of home. This is Central Time.